This is Dr. Herb Bateman in his teaching on the general letters. This is session number 12, Hebrews chapter 2, The Son as the Royal Priest of Promise, part 2.
Hi, my name's Herb Bateman. Today we want to look at Hebrews chapter 2, and we want to focus on the relationship or the introducing of the Son in Hebrews, which we began in Hebrews chapter 1, with a focus on the relationship of the Son to God, to angels, and to humanity. Now, in the first chapter, we saw how God or how the Son related to God the Father, in that he had a relationship equal with God. He was the radiance of His glory, the exact representation of who He was. He was Creator, and so in that sense, there's this equal relationship that God, that the Son has with God. But in addition to that, God's relationship with the Son is that the Son is His messianic Son of Promise, that Jesus fulfills that messianic promise that was initially part of the Abrahamic covenant, because from Abraham's seed there would come kings, but essentially coming out of the Davidic covenant where God promised David that a son would come from his seed or from his loins and would sit on the throne. And we see Psalms written by David to his son, and even a reference to that Davidic promise in chapter 1. So this relationship between Son, as he's introduced in chapter 1, and God is that the Son is seen as divine, equal with God, as well as His messianic Son of Promise. The Son is a divine messianic Son of Promise. And because of that, His relationship to angels is superior. Angels worship Him. Angels serve Him. Angels were created by Him. So the Son has a relationship with God that is equal to Him. The Son is God's divine messianic Son of Promise, who fulfills the promise, and He is superior to angels. In chapter 2, we see an emphasis being placed on the relationship the Son has with humanity. But before we get to that point, in chapter 2, verse 1, the author begins with a warning emerges as a result of chapter 1, verses 1 through 14. And this warning is found in the first four verses of chapter 1. And let me read it to you. Therefore, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard with this result. We don't slip away, or we don't drift away. For if the message spoken through angels proved to be so firm that every violation or disobedience received its just penalty, how will we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? It was first communicated through the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard Him, while God confirmed their witness with signs and wonders and various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to His will. So as we look at this first verse, or this first group of verses, this group of verses is going to be broken up into three parts. First, there's the warning. Then there's the historical failure to obey. And then there's a reference to a verbal confirmation and divine endorsement. Now, Hebrews generally consists of exposition and exhortation of some sort. And we saw an expositional section where the Son is being introduced. Now we're looking at an exhortation that is in the form of a warning. And these warnings appear at least five times in the book of Hebrews. And they are emotive, and they tug at your heart. And they're meant to tug at your heart. They're meant to warn us to not to wander from God, and not to neglect our obligation to continue to obey and follow the Lord. Now, these warning passages will be understood in various ways. It's not a one type of interpretation that everybody agrees with. And so there is a work entitled Four Views on the Warning Passages of Hebrews. And it presents views from Gareth Cockrell, Bust Fanning, Grant Osborne, and Randall Gleason. And you have Arminian views, and then you have Calvin views represented here, stated, and then responded to by each other. So it's a nice book to look at, to use, to get a big picture of the views that are out there. But ultimately, you need to wrestle with the text on your own and figure out where you fall on this on this spectrum of views on Hebrews. But this is a work published by Kriegel, and I've edited it, and it's been out for several years now. So it's a good work to look at, but once again, as we look at this, we're going to be looking at it through my lenses, and just be aware that my view isn't the only one out there. There are other views. So let's begin by looking at the warning itself. It begins with, therefore, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard. Now, this therefore is coming off of chapter 1, and what it's necessary for us to pay attention to is what it is that the author of Hebrews has told us about the Son. We need to pay attention to this. It's important to get this. You need to pay attention to the fact that the Son is a divine messianic son of promise who is superior to angels. Pay attention to that. Don't lose sight of that. The result will be we won't drift away. Now, the word here, drift away, or this rendering, drift away, is one possibility. Another possibility is that it might mean and have a reference to don't lose sight of what you've heard. Don't lose sight of this teaching. This word is used in Proverbs. Of course, the Hebrew scriptures have been translated into Greek. And in Hebrews chapter 9, this word appears in a group of verses that follow the teachings of the king or the author. And at the end of this teachings, the teacher says, don't lose sight of what I just taught you. Don't lose sight of it. That's the same word that's used here. It is possible that the author of Hebrews is saying we must pay closer attention to what we've heard so we don't lose sight of what's been taught. But the other option is to see this term as a way of thinking about drifting away. Both are possibilities. Now, there's a reason why we can't and we ought not to lose sight of this teaching about the Son as the divine messianic son of promise who is superior to the angels. Because if the message spoken through angels proved to be so firm that every violation or disobedience received its just penalty, how will we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? Now, there's a lot of ambiguity in this verse 2 and verse 3. And the author, however, is referring to and alluding to a historical failure to obey. When it talks about, for if the message spoken through angels proved to be so firm that every violation or disobedience received its just penalty, when we think, where in history did angels deliver a message? Well, if you read Josephus, you read Philo, you read in Jubilees, it's generally recognized that angels was the intermediary who delivered the Mosaic Covenant to Moses. Even when you look in the Pentateuch, you've got this indication, this idea, God isn't directly speaking to Moses, but he's speaking through angelic beings or through an angelic being. So this is an allusion that's going back to the message that was received by the Exodus generation. Now the Exodus generation plays a very important role in Hebrews. What happens in Hebrews, the Exodus generation becomes one community that you shouldn't be emulating. Don't be like the Exodus generation. And versus the Christian community, the Jewish Christian community. So these two communities are going to be discussed throughout this book, the Exodus generation and the Jewish community in Rome. So what's being said is, if the message spoken through angels proved to be so firm, such a legally binding document, the word used here, so firm, legally binding, that every violation or disobedience received a just penalty, just think about it. When what was the expectation of the people of Israel? God says, if you obey, these things will be prosperous for you. If you disobey, these things will not be prosperous. And by the way, I could bring people in to carry you off and deport you. And that's exactly what happens in the history of Israel. So he's alluding to, the author is alluding to, a historical failure of the people of Israel. They received a message from Moses, and it was a binding message. You need to do this, and if you don't, this will happen. If you do, this will happen. It was a binding message. And so every violation or disobedience received a just punishment. And when you think about Jeremiah, and you think about the deportations in 586, God makes it perfectly clear, these things are happening because you disobeyed. And the punishments were just. But he takes this argument about what happens to the nation, this historical failure of the Jewish people concerning obedience to the Mosaic Law, and then jumps to believers. How will we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? Of course, he's talking about the salvation that comes through the royal Son of Promise. Remember, in chapter 4, it talks about how he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high after he accomplished what? Cleansings for sins. And so it's through the Son, the Messianic Son of Promise, that we have a great salvation. Let's not neglect it. Let's not turn away from or lose sight of who this Son is. He's God's divine Messianic Son of Promise. And this expectation not to lose sight of it, this great salvation that we have received, isn't without confirmation. In verse 3b to the end, in verse 4, this is what we read. It was first confirmed through the Lord. It was first confirmed through Jesus. You just stop and think about Jesus when he began his ministry. In Mark, the kingdom of God is at hand. A phrase that was repeated over and over again. He He presents himself as Messiah, not the type of Messiah necessarily that the Jewish culture was expecting at the time. He refused to submit to their concept, their theological construct of Messiah, and he defined Messiahship in his terms, which was tribulation, betrayal, suffering, death, and resurrection. But he communicated a great salvation. It was first confirmed and communicated by him, and then it was confirmed to us. And the author is limping himself in with his readers, by us who heard him. So we have heard this message by people who were eyewitnesses. This kind of gives you the indication that perhaps the author of Hebrews was not an eyewitness of these events. In all fairness, perhaps I ought to say a little something about authorship of Hebrews because it is a hotly debated discussion, and generally whenever you talk about Hebrews, everybody wants to talk about who the author is. And there are various perspectives as to who the author of Hebrews is. Number of options are amazing. I mean, we have Barnabas as being the earliest referent as a possible author, and that was presented by Tertullian in 150 to 220. Paul's another option that was presented in 190. Paul, as translated by Luke, was presented by Clement of Rome, or Alexandria. And, of course, Origen, he says he's unknown. Clement of Rome is another possibility, presented in the 300s. Luke was considered as a possibility by Thomas Aquinas in 1260. Apollos was presented as a possibility by Martin Luther in 1522, which, by the way, is probably the most popular view alongside of Origen's view as being unknown. Typically, if you pick up a commentator from a series, you got a 50-50% chance that the author is either going to say he's unknown or he's Apollos today. Another option is Silas in 1825. Another option is Peter, 1892. Now, the reason why Peter probably isn't going to work is because Peter was an eyewitness, and this verse says what? Confirmed by us, by those who heard. So this seems to be a second group of people that weren't eyewitnesses. Philip is another one that probably won't work, but was recommended and suggested in 1899. Priscilla and Aquila is another possibility in 1900, suggested by Harnack. Aristion, suggested in 1905. Stephen, suggested in 1923. The voice of Barnabas, as translated by Luke in 1937. Jude in 1939. Once again, though, he's probably heard, unless this is a different Jude other than Jude, the brother of Jesus. Epaphras was suggested in 1966. Timothy was suggested in 1968. And Mary was suggested in 1976. Now, you can read about all of these in this charts on the book of Hebrews. I list the options and articles where you can read about them. So if you're interested in wrestling with the authorship of Hebrews, this is a work that will help save you time and take you to sources that you can wrestle with it yourself. Personally, if I had to be backed into a corner and had to say choose one other than the unknown, I am content with Barnabas. But I really don't know. But I like the Barnabas option, predominantly because he is seen as being one of the earliest options, and he is known as being a man of encouragement. And this is a book of affirmation and encouragement. But I don't know. And I don't think Barnabas was an eyewitness, so it fits this context. So this message about the son being offering such a great salvation, and we have salvation through the son, it was first confirmed by Jesus himself, and then by those who are eyewitnesses. And then it's confirmed even further by signs and wonders and various types of miracles and gifts. And this verse has nothing to do with the cessation of gifts, or whether they're here or they're not here. The point of the passage is to demonstrate we had verbal testimony and then actions that backed up those verbal testimonies. And you go through the Acts and you can see story upon story where verbal testimony was followed by visible signs to validate the message. So we have a warning. Don't lose sight. We move from warning, don't lose sight of who the Son is, to a historical event, historical failure to obey. And then if we fail to obey, we will be judged, just like the nations of Israel was judged, but our judgment will be even harsher. It's a lesser to greater type of an argument. If that happened to them and their punishment was physical, what do you think's going to happen to us? It's a lesser to them sort of argument. And then, of course, this message, this is about Jesus and what he did, and then the salvation that comes through him is confirmed through divine endorsements. From here, we look at God's plan for the Son. Chapter 2, verses 5 to 9, it talks about God's plan for the Son, or how I've labeled it. He tells us what God's plan is and then tells us what it's not in verses 5 through 8a. So let's look at these verses. For he did not put the world to come, about which we are speaking, under the control of angels. That's the first thing that it's not. The world to come is not under angels. Instead, someone testified somewhere, what is man that you think of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him lower than the angels for a little while. You crowned him with glory and honor. You put all things under his control. So the world is not under the control of angels. It's under the control of this man who is the son. For when he put all things under his control, he left nothing outside of his control. So the author is appealing to a psalm, Psalm 8, that really speaks of God's created order. And just a psalmist appreciating God, what he's done, and then standing back and being amazed that he lets humanity run things, to care for his created order. Let's turn to Psalm 8 and look at this. Psalm 8. In Psalm 8, a music director has composed this psalm, and we read, O Lord, our sovereign master, how magnificent is your reputation. You reveal your majesty in the heavens above. When children and nursing babies cry for help, you protect them from your foes, so that you might put an end to their vindictive enemy. When I look up at the heavens, which your finger made, and see the moon and the stars which you set in place, I think, of what importance is the human race that you should notice them? and make them almost like the heavenly beings. You grant humankind honor and majesty. You allow them to rule over your creation. You have placed everything under their authority, including all the sheep and the cattle, as well as the wild animals, the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, and everything that moves through the channels of the sea. O Lord, our sovereign master, how magnificent is your reputation throughout the earth. And so we see the psalmist taken amazed, standing amazed at God's created order, just appreciating it and praising God for this great universe in which he lives. And yet stands amazed that he allows people to govern it, to rule over it. When this psalm is applied here in Hebrews, humankind, the plural of man, has been changed to a singular. What is man? What is the son that you think of him? Or the son of man that you care for him? And then it makes reference to you made him lower than the angels for a little while, speaking of the son's humanity. You crowned him with glory and honor, speaking of the son's exaltation as a result of his death, burial, and resurrection. And then you put all things under his control. So within this passage, this psalm is being reapplied to Jesus, where humanity is now being narrowed down and zeroing in on one person in the human race that is over all things, and that is the Messianic Son of Promise. Mentions and references his incarnation, references his exaltation, and references the fact that he's got control over all things, that he puts all things under the control of the divine Messianic Son of Promise. What this plan entails is simply this. The Son has control over all things. The angels do not. So we're still in this comparison mode where angels are seen in chapter 1 as created by the Son. The angels are the ones who worship the Son. The angels are the ones who are set out to serve the Son, and those they serve are those who are saints, and angels do not rule in the future. It's the Son. But the author of Hebrews also recognizes that there's a tension here. Because in the next group of verses 8c to 9, we see that God's plan is just partially executed. Look with me as we read at the end of verse 8 and pick up through verse 9. At present, we do not see all things under his control. So we have an already not yet situation manifesting itself. On the one hand, Jesus, the Son, this divine messianic Son of Promise, is in control of all things. But on the other hand, there's a future consummation of his control yet to come. But we see Jesus, who's made lower than the angels for a little while, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, because he died, with this result, that by God's grace he would experience death on behalf of everyone. So here's a reference to, again, referring to chapter 1, verse 3, about him accomplishing the cleansing of sins. We're coming right back to that and expand it a little bit here. He suffered death with this result. God's grace would experience death on behalf of everyone. Jesus died. His death, burial, and resurrection, that death, that event, was on behalf of everyone. Seems to echo 1 John 2 as well. 2:2. So the point is that Jesus is seen as his plan is being partially executed at this time. The other thing that is worthy of noting concerning this tension is that this isn't the first time we've seen this already not yet aspect of Jesus' rule or the Son's rule. We see it in chapter 1, verse 13, where the author quotes Psalm 110, "Sit at my right hand. I'm giving you authority. You have authority, you have power. And sit there until I make your enemies a footstool to your feet." So there's an already aspect of his rule, but yet a future aspect yet to come, and where all things will be subdued and placed under the control of the divine messianic Son of Promise. Then we move from God's plan for the Son to the Son's relationship with believers. And we see this in verses 10 through 13. We first see the Son glorified as royal priest, and then we see the Son's declared relationship with believers. "For it was fitting for him, for whom and through whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through sufferings." So here we have the reason for this experiencing death. It was fitting for him, it was fitting for the Son, for whom and through whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory. It was fitting. It was part of God's plan for the Son to go through these this experience of death and resurrection. It was part of God's plan. And when we think about the theology of the general letters and how it fits into God's overall big picture, remember we talked about this in the past where once sin entered into the world, God didn't just decide to annihilate everything and begin again. He set into a motion to reestablish his kingdom rule and to redeem a people to enter into that kingdom. And he does it through promises, the promise to Abraham, and then the promise to David, which is built upon the promise of Abraham. Then you've got the New Covenant promises, which is based upon the Davidic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant. You just can't take one out without the other. They are a package deal. And God is progressively working his way through to fulfill and keep those promises. God is a God of promise, particularly as it pertains to the Abrahamic, Davidic, and New Covenant, and the reestablishing his kingdom rule on earth and to redeem a people in that kingdom. Jesus fulfills those promises. Jesus, it was part of God's plan. It was fitting for Jesus to suffer those things in his incarnation in order to accomplish the plan that God had established long, long ago. It's through him that all things exist. We saw that in chapter 1 as well. He sustains all things by the powerful word. And then we move to make the bringing of sons to glory, to make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through sufferings. Here Jesus is referred to as a pioneer. It's one of few times it appears in Scripture. And it has to do with founding. A pioneer is someone oftentimes used to describe somebody who's a founder of a city, someone who establishes a city. Jesus is described as one who is founder of our salvation, the founder of the opportunity to have a relationship with God and perfecting or completing that plan of God. The perfecting, the idea of perfecting here is to bring to maturity, but to complete what it was that God had intended. So here again, we're right back to Jesus, this Son, the Messianic Son of Promise, is completing God's plan to redeem a people to enter into his kingdom. Now, in verses 11 through 13, we have the Son's declared relationship with believers. Now, before I read these verses, I want to talk about astonishing relationships. I think of the movie entitled Blind Side. Blind Side is about a man or a boy at the time, a young boy, who is homeless and manages to find his way into a family in the South. Now, this is an African-American boy who has nothing. He is seen wandering the streets. And a Southern belle asks, "Do you have a place to stay tonight?" "Don't lie to me." "No, ma'am. You come home with us." And she brings this African-American into her home. He lives with them. And eventually the family adopts this this young man into their family. And there's one scene where he left home to get his head together about an event that had taken place. And this young Southern belle goes looking for him. And it's a bad part of town. And it with just very poor, desolate place. And so she goes to look for his adopted son, this young man. And she comes across this group of guys sitting in the corner. And she said, "Have you seen so-and-so?" And the guy said, "I haven't. But when I see him, you just tell him." And he makes some type of threatening mark. And this was her response. "You threaten my son, you threaten me. I'm packing." To me, that's astonishing. We're talking about the Deep South, where a Southern belle, a Southern young woman, a Southern woman, takes into her family, and not just her, her husband and kin, her children, bring into their family this African American, and she says, "He's my son. You threaten him. You threaten me." That's astonishing. But there is a relationship that's even more astonishing than that. It's the relationship of the divine messianic Son of Promise says to me, "You're my brother. You're my sister." That's even more astonishing. Look what the text says here in verse 11 and 12, or 11 through 13. "For indeed, he who makes holy and those being made holy, all have the same origin." Here's the representation. The one who makes holy, that's the Son, and those who are being made holy, they all have the same origin. They are all human. There is a solidarity in the humanity because of the incarnate Son's and his relationship now with humanity. And so he is not ashamed to call them, that is believers, brothers and sisters. saying, I will proclaim your name, my brothers. I will proclaim the name of Yahweh to my brothers, regardless of what's going on. I will proclaim Yahweh to my brothers. In the midst of the assembly, I will praise you. Again, he says, I will be confident in who? Yahweh. Just like we are to manifest our confidence and trust in Yahweh, the Son, the Messianic Son of Promise, is saying, I, too, am confident in Yahweh, in God the Father. Here I am with the children God has given me. Now, I really like this verse 12 because it talks about, I will proclaim your name to my brothers. And it's a quote taken here from Psalm 22. Psalm 22, verse 22. And when we go to Psalm 22, a lot of times what we think about is Jesus saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is a psalm, actually, it's a lament psalm. This is about a guy who's going through some tough troubles. But despite the troubles that he's going through, at one point in the psalm he says, despite my troubles, I'm still going to go to the assembly and praise your name. So let's look at Psalm 22. Psalm 22, and it is a rather lengthy psalm, but I'm still going to read it all. We'll see how we do with time. My God, why do you reject me? I groan in prayer, but help seems far away. Once again, this is a lament psalm that a person is feeling. He's feeling distanced from God. This is a psalm written by people, by a person that many people feel as they're living through life. God, why have you left me? Why have you forsaken me? My God, I cry out during the day, but you do not answer. And during the night, my prayers do not let up. You are sovereign. You sit as king over the worshiping community of Israel. In you, our ancestors trusted. They trusted in you, and you rescued them. To you they cried out, and they were saved. In you they trusted, and they weren't disappointed. But I feel like a worm, not a man. People insult me and despise me, and all who see me taunt me. They mock me, and they shake their heads. They say, commit yourself to the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Let the Lord deliver him, for he delights in him. Yes, you are the one who pulled me from the womb and made me feel secure in my mother's breast. I have been dependent on you since birth, from the time I came out of my mother's room. You have been my God. Do not remain far from me, for trouble is near, and I've got no one to help me. My many bulls surround me, powerful bulls of Bashan hem me in. Oh, cows of Bashan again. Here they come. Amos, you know, the fat, luxurious, the wealthy, the bulls of Bashan, they hem me in. They get ready to devour me like roaring lion that rips its prey. My strength drains away like water. All my bones are dislocated. My courage is like wax. It melts. The roof of my mouth is so dry as a piece of pottery. My tongue sticks to my gums. You are making me descend to the grave. Yes, wild dogs surround me. A gang of evil men crowd around me like lion. They pin my hands and my feet to the ground. I can count all my bones. My enemies are gloating over me in triumph. They are dividing up my clothes among themselves. They are rolling dice for my garment. But you, O Lord, do not remain far away. You are my source of strength. Hurry and help me. Deliver me from the sword. Save my life from the paws of the wild dog. Rescue me from the mouth of the lion, from the horns of the wild oxen. You answer me. Verse 22, I will declare your name to my countrymen. In the middle of the assembly, I will praise you. So in the midst of his turmoil, in the midst of everything that's going on, he is still going to praise God in the midst of the assembly, in the midst of those with whom he worships. Hebrews. He's called the Son, the Messianic Son of Promise, says, I will proclaim your name to my brothers. He worships God with us. Then we have, I will praise you. And this is a quote from Psalm 122, and it says, and I will be confident in him. And this is a reference from Isaiah 8 about having his confidence in God. And here I am with the children God has given me. This is from Isaiah 8 where Isaiah is recognizing his two sons are being children that God gave him. Jesus sees us as his children that God has given him. What an astonishing relationship that we have. Then the author moves into explaining this relationship in a little bit more detail in verses 14 to 18. The intentional result for sharing in our humanity is found in verses 14 to 15. Therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, he likewise shared in their humanity, so that through death he could destroy the one who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and set free those who are held in slavery all their lives by the fear of death. So two things are coming out of this verse. Two results come out of the death of Jesus in this verse. The one result is that Satan, the devil, has been hindered and incapacitated. The second result is that the instrument that Satan uses to bring fear into the lives of people has been destroyed. The fear of death is gone. Satan cannot use the instrument of death to say, better fear death, you don't know what's going to happen on the other side of that grave. Jesus took that fear of death away because we have a relationship with God and our sins have been atoned for. So two results. Satan has been incapacitated and the fear of death has been eliminated. Next, we have limitations to what the Son has done as a result of his shared humanity. And this is we see in verse 16. Once again, we're going back to angels. For surely his concern is not for angels, but his concern is for Abraham's descendants, men and women who are justified because of their belief in the divine Messianic Son of Promise. The Son's acts, his death, burial, resurrection, was not for angelic beings. It's for people like you and me. And then finally, the chapter closes with the Son's qualifications in verses 17 to 18. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers and sisters in every respect, so that he could become a merciful and faithful priest in the things relating to God. So the result of becoming like us was simply this: he might become a merciful priest and a faithful priest in everything as it pertains to God. Merciful and faithful. And this is setting up the stage for what's going to happen in the descriptions of Jesus or this Son, this divine Messianic Son of Promise in chapter 4. He is a merciful and faithful high priest in things relating to God to make atonement for the sins of people. For since he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are tempted. We do not have a divine messianic son of promise who doesn't understand us. He knows us. He knows what it means to be human. He knows what it means to be tempted. He knows what it means to be merciful. He knows what it means to be faithful. So there we have it, chapter 2. We see the warning of the author as he talks about the Son as the messianic Son of promise. We see God's plan for the Son, and how it is that the Son has fulfilled God's plan, established from the very beginning of creation. We see how the Son relates to us and calls us brothers and sisters. What an astonishing relationship. And closes with how his relationship makes it possible to be able to go to him because he is a merciful and faithful high priest who understands us. Thank you. And until the next time, I trust you'll have a great day. Walk with the King and be a blessing to those that you come in contact with.
This is Dr. Herb Bateman in his teaching on the General Letters. This is session number 12, Hebrews chapter 2, The Son as the Royal Priest of Promise, part 2.